All right, so yesterday we have done, we have recasted the Maxwell's theory in relativistic notations, and really the key thing is to realize that I can capture the information about E and B in this two tensor F mu nu, which is antisymmetric in indices mu and nu. That's why it has six components. And you can also write it in terms of the potentials like this here. And if you do it explicitly, you'll find that it's precisely capturing the information about E and B. So the zero I components contain information about E's, and the spatial components contain information about B's. So then the Maxwell equations, those without sources, become just this ugly expression. You take mu nu, you partial differentiate, and you take cyclic permutations so that you have three terms in total, and it gives zero. Or a nicer form of that equation is this one here, where you take a Hodge tool of F mu nu, and then partial derivative is zero here. And so that basically, both these equations are satisfied by setting F mu nu equal to a potential. The other two, the other four equations are given here, and those are those with sources. Of course, J nu was just a combination of the charge density and the current here. Finally, there is a Lorentz force law, which I will have to elaborate on today, but basically, the derivative of a momentum is the Lorentz force, and it has to be linear in the tensor F mu nu, and it has to be linear in the velocity of the particle, and so there's nothing else you can write down. Well, that's not true. What about a tensor like this? Well, that's not good. F nu nu u mu. Could I write something like this? It's linear in u. Could I write something like that?
What's
this? F nu nu, and then u mu. So instead of F mu nu u nu, where I'm contracting over this index, I would contract the index on F, and then I would do this thing here.
It seems like it should be zero, right? Because F nu nu, because F is antisymmetric.
Exactly. So this would actually be zero because F mu nu is antisymmetric. So if you trace over antisymmetric matrix, you are adding these zeros here and you get zero. So this is certainly not a good candidate for Lorentz force. Okay. So I'll have to elaborate on what this u nu means and what this p mu means. I'll do it in a minute. But before I go there, let me just show you the charge conservation in this form. It's super simple. You just take this equation and you differentiate with respect to the remaining, with respect to the remaining free index. So you write d nu, d mu, F mu nu, which is minus 4 pi d nu j nu, okay? And if you do that, what do you think you are getting here?
Zero.
You are getting zero. Why is it so? Is you have an object which is symmetric in indices nu and mu. I am in physics, I can swap the partial derivatives. So this guy is symmetric in nu and mu, but this guy is antisymmetric in mu and nu, in nu and mu. And so whenever you sum over symmetric times antisymmetric, you get zero. Of course, it's simple to show. If I have symmetric part, I can swap these indices and nothing happens. But if I have antisymmetric one, if I swap them, I pick up a minus sign. Okay. And then you can rename the indices by swapping both of them, and you find that the result equals to minus the same result. And of course, that result has to be equal to zero. Okay, so this thing is automatically zero, and so it's that simple to show that d nu, j nu, has to be equal to zero out of here, which is the current conservation, or current conservation. And it's a consistency equation. It has to be satisfied for the solutions of Maxwell equation. If I am to write down this equation and if I am to solve it, you know, this must be true, right? Because this is an identity. Okay, so we have decomposed in the past into rho and j parts, and then we said, well, if I integrate over rho, over the volume, that defines my charge. And then this charge is conserved as long as there is no flux through boundary. So now the same thing can be written without actually decomposing this thing into time and spatial directions. And so you know that this is true. And you simply take this expression here, which is a scalar, and you integrate it over a space-time domain. Okay, so I take a domain, which is now in space-time. So this is my domain omega, this is time, and this is space. Okay, and you simply integrate over a piece of space-time. Okay, so let me do it. So we know that it's zero, so integral over omega d nu j nu d4 of x, where I mean dt d3x. Okay, so let's do that. So now there is a beautiful theorem, again, the Stokes theorem. I have a derivative on this thing, so I can bring it to a derivative, to an integral over the boundary. So now this space-time region omega has some boundary, which is this thing here, which is my d omega. And so I can write this as an integral over d omega j nu d sigma nu, where this is just the volume integral on that boundary. Okay, so in particular, this happens at, okay, so that's integral over the boundary. Very good. So now I can choose the boundary to be nice if I take omega basically to be the whole of space-time. So this is the time direction, this is the space direction. So let's say this slice here, I can choose coordinates so that this is actually t equal to t0 or something like that, or t equal to 0. Okay, so this slice is t equal to 0 surface. This slice is t equal to some later time, so equal later time. So let's call that surface sigma t, let's call this surface sigma 0. And then you have the boundary here. But of course, I can make these surfaces to go all the way to infinity if you want, or not really if I want to keep the boundary at finite. But anyway, so this is just the boundary at, let's say, r equal to constant or whatever. There is another boundary here. Okay. So what it means is that my surface integral basically goes into three pieces. It will be an integral over sigma 0, and then j nu d sigma nu. And then it will be an integral over the boundary, j nu d sigma nu. And if I take into account the orientation of the surface, so the orientation is always inside, so this will be like that, this will be like that, this will be like that, this will be like that. So it's obvious this way, if I'm taking an integral over sigma 0 to be plus, so if I swap this arrow, it will be a minus. Okay, so this is minus integral over sigma t j nu d sigma nu. And the whole thing is equal to 0. Very good. So now the statement as before, if there is no flux through the boundary, which is this is measuring, you know, how much current is going through my boundary. So if no flux through the boundary, then this thing, of course, goes to 0. So this term is not here. And then you simply conclude, because the whole thing is equal to 0, is that the integral over sigma 0 of j nu d sigma nu is equal to an integral over some later time of the same thing, d sigma nu. In other words, I calculate a quantity on the sigma 0, and then I arbitrarily evolved in time, and it's equal to a quantity on some later time, sigma t. It's a conservation law, right? So no matter which t I choose, the integral will always be the same, provided there is no flux through the boundary. And so this is natural to call the conserved quantity the charge, and this is a covariant definition of the charge. So you don't need to split your j nu into the time part and the spatial part, but you can just integrate this over some constant over some hypersurface in your space-time, and this will give you a conserved charge. Of course, if I choose the coordinates that this is really, you know, a normal going along the time direction, then this will only have zero component, will be nu zero and j zero here, and j zero is rho. So that's that you can come back. But more generally, you can take any hypersurface which sweeps your spacetime, and it will be the conserved charge. Questions? Yes?
So in the first step, you went from over the whole surface to a...
So here I went over the... So the integral was over this domain.
Yeah.
Well, over the whole thing.
Yeah, the whole thing.
And then you go to an integral over just the boundary.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the next parts... Well, we only have three pieces of the boundary.
Oh, well, there's one boundary here. There's another boundary here.
Okay.
Let's say B1 and B2, but I call the whole thing as just B.
Okay.
But you could have a flux of things, you know, going through this boundary and going through that boundary, in which case you wouldn't have charge conservation.
Mm-hmm.
But if you typically you consider this boundary at infinity, and so then there's no flux of particles at infinity or something like that.
Okay.
All right, so we have that. Yeah. So let me finally understand this thing here. And in order to understand this thing here, we need to discuss relativistic particle. So let's discuss relativistic particle. Okay, and so basically relativistic particle is a one-dimensional object which sweeps a trajectory in the space-time. So if you have, again, you have t, and then you have x, or ct and x, so we can now unify by having this absolute speed c. You can treat this as a length coordinate. And then simply the particle sweeps a trajectory here. So you can always trace t as a function of x. Or more generally, you can parameterize this in terms of a parameter lambda. So this is really, you know, given the lambda is the parameter which goes along this curve, I can find where I was and when I was. Okay, and then at each point, you have a tangent vector, which is basically the velocity of that particle, dx mu over d lambda. So lambda is a parameter characterizing my trajectory. And if it can be anything, it doesn't have to be proper time. It can be whatever the parameter uniquely characterizes my trajectory here. And then you would say that dx mu over d lambda is not really a forward velocity, but it's a parametric forward velocity, because I haven't specified what my lambda is. Parametric forward velocity. Of course, that is a vector which is always tangent to my trajectory. Okay, so now because we have one-dimensional trajectory which looks like line, this trajectory is sometimes called world line. Okay, so this is the world line. And that's how we describe relativistic particles. So now what you can do is that in principle you can look at the magnitude of this parametric forward velocity. So you can look at the magnitude is using the metric which we have in our Minkowski spacetime, the eta mu nu metric. So you can look at the quantity dx mu over d lambda, dx nu over d lambda. So this is like velocity. This is like velocity square, but now using this strange matrix eta. And in general, you would find three possibilities. you could have, this could be smaller than zero, zero, or bigger than zero. So if it's bigger than zero, you would say that the trajectory is space-like. And that's not interesting for physics. Well, it is, but not for particles. It can be equal to zero. You would say that the trajectory is null, or light-like. And it's precisely how photons behave. So if you have massless particles, for them, it would be precisely, you would find that this is equal to zero. And then you can have smaller than zero, so that means time-like trajectory. And this would be just the normal massive particles. So it's a cold, hard truth, the statement of life, that the massive particles, massive observers, move on everywhere time-like trajectories. So that means if I calculate this thing at any point on my trajectory, I will find that this thing is smaller than zero. Okay? So massive particles always behave like that. And of course, what that means is that my propagation is within light cone. Okay, so if I draw a light cone everywhere, not nice light cone. But anyway, 45 degrees light cone, supposed to be. It will not be better, I think. Okay. So that means at every point, if I draw this light cone, I'm always traveling inside it. So this, the light cone is like this thing here. So I have to be traveling inside. Okay, so that's how massive trajectories have to look like. If you had space-like trajectories, they would go outside of the light cone. They would propagate faster than light. Okay. All right, so for these massive particles, what you can do is that you can change your parameter. So it has always have to be negative. And so you can choose a special lambda now, for which it is minus one. Why not? Okay, so massive particles. So for massive particles, we can introduce a special parameter, which we call the proper time. Which is just one special, it's called tau, which is just one special choice of lambda. And it's simply that I normalize what this has to be everywhere on the trajectory. And you can always achieve that by reparametrizing lambda. Okay, and so that's defined by eta mu nu dx mu over d tau dx mu over d tau equals to minus one. So that's the definition of the proper time, if you want. It's a special parameter, and it satisfies this. And of course, you can also write it if you want. I can just treat it as a physicist, and I can multiply by d tau square. And so then you have a formula that d tau is a square root of minus eta mu nu dx mu dx nu. Okay? So that's sometimes how people write this. But what is important here is that you see that all the indices are contracted here, and so this is a Lorentz scalar. So it does not transform under Lorentz transformations, and in any frame, this will be the same quantity. Questions? Okay, so let's use this to look at how my proper time parameter tau is related to my time coordinate t. Okay, so in particular, let's now parameterize our trajectory not with tau, but with the t coordinate. So then I find that the tau equals to, okay. So the trick is to divide by dt. And so basically now I'll treat my trajectory as a function of time coordinate t. I divide by dt and multiply by dt and nothing changes. So this is minus eta mu nu dx mu dt dx nu dt. And then dt, nothing has changed. I divide it by dt and I multiply by dt. Okay, so this is still true. So now if I remind you, our coordinates in the spacetime are of course just t and xi. And our eta mu nu just looks like minus 1, 1, 1, 1, where this is the time direction and these are the xi directions. Okay, so what's really written here is that if I choose mu and nu equal to 0, and it's just dt over dt and dt over dt, so it just gives me minus 1. And then, okay. So this is just dt. So if I have 0, 0 component, it just gives me 1. And if I have an I component, it just gives me xi. So it's minus dxi dt squared. Okay, it's because of the form of eta mu nu and because of my choice of coordinates. So in other words, we derived a beautiful formula that this is dt over gamma, where gamma is your favorite Lorentz factor, 1 over square root 1 minus v square. So this is just the velocity as we know it. It's the coordinate velocity, dx over dt, which we can call v. And then this is just a Lorentz factor. Everybody happy? All right, hooray. So now we know what a proper time is, and we know how to relate it with a coordinate time. And we know the massive particles are such that this interval is always negative, but we can normalize it to be minus 1. So now let's really look at the motion of the particles as we know them. And so the first thing is to define the proper form velocity. So we had dx mu over d lambda, which was the parametric velocity. But now let's do it with respect to the proper time, which is the distinguished parameter. And so then we just call that a form velocity. So for velocity of the particle, now without the word parametric, is simply defined to be u mu, which is dx mu over d tau. So it's like the parametric velocity, but now we choose this parameter to be our proper time. All right, and of course, so that's the definition. And it behaves like a vector. So this is a Lorentz scalar. If you do a derivative on coordinates, the result will be a vector. Okay, that's not true if you divide it by dt. T is just a coordinate. It's not a Lorentz scalar because it depends on the velocity through this thing here. But for proper time, this will be a vector. Okay, but now I can write it as dx mu over dt using the chain rule dt over d tau. And you would call, okay, so what is this? So dt over d tau is just gamma. And then if you calculate dx mu over dt, so if mu is 0, then it's just 1. And then you have the velocity here, as you know it. So this is the form of the form velocity. Thank you. having defined the four velocity, we can define the four momentum. And then we know all the quantities in this equation here. So the four momentum Okay, so to this, we need to talk about the mass of the particle. Okay, the momentum is mass times the velocity. So fortunately or unfortunately, the mass of the particle depends on how fast the particle is moving, or you know, which frame we are observing that. But so in general, the mass of the particle will be a function of the velocity. And how this is defined is that it depends on this gamma factor times something which is independent of velocity. Okay, and so this independent thing is the rest mass of the particle. Rest mass of a particle. And I'm not going to show it to you how this is derived. You can look it up in any book. But basically, you know, what this is really I look at the mass of the particle in the frame where I'm sitting on the particle. And so this would be the mass I measure then. So then if I'm moving or if the particle is moving, its mass actually gets distorted by this motion and by the velocity, and it's captured by this gamma factor here. Okay, but what is important is that this thing here is really the rest mass, which does not depend on any frame I am in, right? So the rest mass is simply the mass of the particle which I measure when I sit on it, right? And that's a Lorentz invariant quantity, right? So that's simply defined once and for all. And so because this is a Lorentz scalar, now I can make a vector p mu to be m0 times the four velocity. Okay, and this will still be a vector because this guy is a Lorentz scalar. It doesn't depend on frame. It's just defined to be the rest mass of the particle. Okay, and that's our momentum. And if you look at this thing here, of course I can use this expression for the four velocity. So this thing here will just be gamma m0, so it will be gamma m0, and it will be gamma m0v, just using this formula here. But we know that gamma m0 is just the mass from this formula here. And so what stands here is just the standard p as you know it. So it's just the mass of the particle times the velocity. But just be careful that the mass can depend on the velocity. So this is just gamma m0 times p, where I define to be mv. But now m is the m measured in my frame. Okay? So this is how the momentum looks like. Very good.
So with this mass dependency on the velocity, how do we define what's the equivalence principle in special relativity? Like,
what do you mean, Axel?
This, like, is it the gravitational mass or only the inertial mass or both?
Well, there is no gravity in special relativity, right? Once you have gravity, you don't have special relativity. So this would be without gravity, but you would take. Of course, what the gravity would couple to would be then the actual mass in your frame, right? Gravity couples to your t mu nu, and the t mu nu captures all the effects of velocities and whatever. All right. So now I haven't proved this. But you can look it up in Z's book or you know any book on special relativity. And you know, this thing sort of makes sense in order to define the momentum simply as mv. So I have no any other option. If I want p to be here, then I have to have m, you know, I have to call gamma m0 to be m. Okay. So now let me use the most beautiful formula ever in physics, which is equal to mc squared. So Einstein's formula so you will look at its derivation in the relativity course. And so basically you'll follow Einstein's derivation, not the original one, that's quite complicated, but the simplified version of Einstein's derivation of the formula E equals to mc squared, mc squared. Of course, c is 1, so it's just m. So you will prove this, don't worry. So see tutorial in the relativity course. But then if I use this, of course, I should have continued here. So this is just m and p. But I can also write, instead of m, I can write e. OK, so my p mu now becomes E and P, okay, using this formula here. Okay, and then the fun thing is to look at P square. So P square, P mu, P mu, which is eta mu nu, P mu, P nu. Okay, so I need an P mu is indexed down, which is just bringing a minus sign here. It's minus e square plus p vector square. And that's the formula you will be using in your quantum field theory course all the time. Is that the magnitude of the four momentum is given by minus energy square plus the magnitude of the three momentum. Or I can solve it for e. And so E will be P square. OK, I need one more step. So this is a Lorentz scalar. And so I can evaluate it in the frame where this thing is not moving. If this thing is not moving, then P is 0 and gamma is 1. So this must be also equal to minus m0 square. Okay? So p square is a Lorentz scalar. I can evaluate it in any frame I want. So I look at this formula here. And so gamma is 1 if I'm not moving and p is 0. So this must be equal to m minus m0 square. And then you have that e square is p square plus m square. OK, and that's the formula everybody likes. OK, so now I can look at two cases. Case one, so this formula is actually surprisingly valid for both massive and massless particles. So it will be true for photons as well. But of course, photons, they have zero rest mass. OK, so we have massless particles. So if you have massless particles, that means that the zero mass is actually equal to 0. And then we find a beautiful relation, which was already known to Einstein when he was deriving this formula here, is that just the energy of photons is given by the magnitude of the momentum. If we have massive particles, I don't have space here, but let's do it here. If we have massive particles, then I can actually take the mass out of that formula. So I have E equals to m0 and then square root 1 plus b vector square divided by m0 square. And if your momenta, if your particles are moving slowly, then the momentum will be much smaller than the rest mass. So I can do the Taylor expansion. So So this will be equal to m0, 1 plus 1 half b square over m0 square plus other terms. And so this is equal to m0 plus 1 half b square over m plus blah, blah, blah. And so for the massive particles, you see that the energy of a massive particle, so the first approximation, if the particle is moving slowly, is just given by the rest mass. And then there's a tiny correction to that, which is just b squared over 2m, which is the Hamiltonian which we are typically writing. And then it would have higher order corrections here. OK, so this is the rest mass. And so the rest energy, of course, you know, if I return back c, then I have to have units of energy. So E equals to m0 c squared, and then energy p squared over 2m0. OK. Very good. So now this is almost everything we need. The last thing is to formulate the second Newton's law. And we have all the quantities. So then the second Newton's law well, we would have dp over dt equals to force. So now we know that we can replace p with the four momentum p mu. And in order this to be a four vector, we have to do dp mu over d tau. So that will be the force. And that's the Newton's law. So this is a four force. Oh, no. And that's the second Newton's law, as you know it, in relativistic notation. OK? And so in particular, I can take the four force given by the Lorentz force law. Obviously, this is a four force. It's just a vector in the end, f mu. It's just given by f mu u nu, where u nu is the four velocity defined here, so on. So interestingly, if you have no force, then you have a free particle. And such particles move on geodesics, which are straight lines in here. So geodesics, which in special relativity have to be straight lines. And of course, for that, I better recover that dp mu over d tau equals to 0. OK? And so such an equation, so in this case, we have dp mu over d tau equals to 0. And you can recover this equation from an action principle. And so you can write down the action for a free particle. And so what it could be, OK, so the action, very good. So the action has to have units of energy times time. So energy times time. OK, very good. So to capture the units and to capture the fact that the particle has a mass, so this will have units of energy. And then I need to integrate over time. But time is not a Lorentz scalar, and the action better be a Lorentz scalar. OK, so the only possibility I have here to have a Lorentz scalar is, of course, the proper time here. OK, so now this is the action for the point particle. And so you know that you want to extremize the action in order to derive the equations of motion. So if I am extremizing the action here, what it means is that I am extremizing the proper time. Well, that's nice, right? So my motion is defined to be, well, I travel from one point in space-time to another point in space-time. And I do it in such a way that it takes the extremal proper time. OK, so now you are probably used to the fact that if you go from one place to another and then you go the straight line, it typically takes the smallest amount of time. Okay, so here, because of the screwed up minus sign in the metric minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, it will be now maximum instead of minimum. So actually what we want to do is to find maximizing the proper time. Proper time. Okay, so that's what we want to do in order to derive this. But of course, well, this is a beautiful thing, and it really tells you what we are doing geometrically. We are trying to extremize the proper time it takes going from one place to another. But that's not how you would calculate and how you would derive this dp mu over d tau. Instead, you use the formula for d tau, which I already deleted, maybe, which is this one here. Okay. So now I can write this d tau as minus m0 c square integral over minus eta mu nu. Now I can take any parameter lambda dx nu over d lambda. And this is how you would find your...
See why we have the minus sign, then it has to be a maximum.
I'm not saying it, okay. It's true. It's true. I don't know how to show it now, but it's true. Okay. So really the fact that you are not trying to minimize it, but rather maximize it, that's encoded in the fact that you have the minus sign. Okay. So this is how you would calculate it. So of course now lambda is an arbitrary parameter, and your action has reparametrization invariance. I can choose going from lambda to lambda prime. And this form of the action will not change. Okay? So what do I find for the Hamiltonian if I go to the Hamiltonian picture?
Zero.
Okay, so if I preserve this reparametrization invariance in this form, then and then you go to the Hamiltonian picture, you would find that it's a totally constrained system, and you would find Hamiltonian equal to zero. At the same time, if I fix parameter lambda to be something else, let's say the time coordinate t, you would find that then everything is fine. If you do the gauge fixing first and reduce some degree of freedom in your you lose this reparametrization invariance, but at the same time you find more standard behavior of the system. Anyway, so this is your Lagrangian, and then so Lagrangian now is a function of x mu and dx mu over d lambda, and the parameter is lambda. And you can write down the Euler-Lagrange equations for this Lagrangian, and you will do it in tutorial today. And you will find that this is the true equation coming from there. Or you can actually do it with the electromagnetic force, and then you will derive this thing here. Okay? So that's what you will have fun today about geodesics and flat space and the Lorentz force law. Are there any questions about the particle?
What's the time component of the four forms?
Oh, that's a good question. I'll leave that up to you. But it's an interesting to look at what the time component of this thing actually is. And we can do it in a concrete case of this thing here. And you'll find something interesting. So it's not only the standard Newton's law captured here, but it's something extra captured there in that four force. It's fun. All right. So we have particles. And I almost don't have any time, but let me go very quickly to relativistic field theories. And that's where you will start your QFT course, so we at least should touch on this. So part B will be relativistic And so let me do it in the Lagrangian picture. You can do it in Hamiltonian as well, but okay. So now you want to formulate your action principle. So now it's an action functional, but now your variable is the field. And of course, this field depends now on both space and time coordinates. So it depends on t and x, or you can just write it as phi of x mu. Okay? So now you're interested in the field, which depends on two labels, the time label and the position label, or on space-time coordinates x mu. Okay? So that's so now the action, and we've seen this for our vibrations of the string, is that the action for these field theories is simply given by the Lagrangian density integrated over space and time. Okay, so now we have the Lagrangian density here. And the Lagrangian density, in principle, depends on the field. But it can depend also on the derivatives of the field. And it can depend on space-time coordinates, x mu. And then you integrate over space and time, which you combine simply into d4x here. Okay, so that's your action. And then you can extremize this action. And you do it exactly in the same way, where you do the variations delta on this action. And the variations of delta were such that they were only doing something with the fields, with the coordinates, right? But not with the labels, not with time. So that means that, you know, variation delta will just touch the field phi, but will do nothing now with the coordinates, with the labels t and x. Okay, so now we have delta s. It better be equal to 0, imposing the action principle. And it's simply given by dl over d phi, delta phi, dl over d mu phi, delta d mu phi, and that's it. I'm not doing anything with the coordinates. It's not the delta tilde, but it's just this thing here. Okay, the next step is to move this stupid derivative out of delta phi. Of course, delta and d mu, again, commute. It's the same thing like d over dt commutes with delta. It's just, you know, this does something to the coordinates, and this does something to the fields, but they commute. They have nothing to do with each other. So this thing here is d mu delta of phi. And I want to integrate by parts to again, move this derivative from the delta onto that term. Okay, and if you do that, so by parts. You got. So this is an integral over some space-time domain omega. Let's do it over omega here. And then we have, this term is unchanged, dl over d phi. And if I integrate by parts, I move this one here, but I pick up a minus sign. So it's minus d mu dl over d mu phi delta phi d4x. But I, again, pick up a boundary term. So it should be plus, minus, I don't know, doesn't matter. D omega, d3 sigma mu, dl over d mu phi, delta phi. Okay, so so my action is defined in some space-time domain omega. If I integrate by parts, I pick up a boundary term, which means I have to integrate over d omega, which is this term. That's the boundary term which we had before. Okay, so now I can kill this boundary term exactly in the same way. Sorry?
It is plus.
Yeah, it should be plus, I think so. Thank you. Well, it's always better to write minus first, right? Because then you can change it to plus easily. All right. So now I can kill this term by again saying I have fixed endpoints on my field, which means on the boundary, I don't admit any variations of delta phi. So here I impose the delta phi equals to 0 on the boundary, and I only have arbitrary variations inside. Okay, so this thing vanishes, provided that I have fixed endpoints, meaning delta phi on the boundary equals to 0. Okay, so I killed the boundary term, and so inside omega, delta phi is arbitrary. So the only possibility how to impose the action principle is that this guy has to be equal to 0. And so now we arrived at the Euler-Lagrange equations for fields. So Euler-Lagrange equations for fields, and they are dl over d phi minus d mu dl over d mu phi equals to 0. And of course, this is precisely the same thing as we had in classical mechanics, except that in classical mechanics, mu could only run not from 0, 1, 2, 3, but it could only run over time, right? So q, generalized coordinates, were fields which were functions of time only. There was no space here, right? So if I just take mu equal to 0, then I go back to the classical mechanics case. Everybody happy with this? Anybody not seen this? But is it okay or, yeah? Great. All right, so now we have the field equations for the fields. Of course, interesting thing is again the Noether's theorem and the conserved quantities for fields. And let me just formulate this Noether's theorem, the explicit version of it. So of course, again, the most general version will be true if we have some symmetry of our action here, then, and in this symmetry is global and continuous symmetry, there will be a corresponding conserved charge or corresponding conserved current. Okay, they are in 1-to-1. Once we have conserved current, we have conserved charge by the construction I showed you a minute ago. All right, so let's do the explicit version. So Noether's theorem for fields. And so again, you can do the variations. So you have one variation delta where you keep fixed the coordinates, but then you can talk about variations delta tilde where you are allowed to change coordinates as well. Okay, in the same way as we were changing t to t prime in the particle case, now we can change x to x prime. So we can change both the fields and the coordinates as well. So let delta tilde be a global continuous symmetry so that is off shell. Again, I'm not imposing the equations of motion here. We find delta tilde x mu, which is x mu prime minus x mu, and delta tilde of phi x mu, which is phi prime x prime mu minus phi x mu. So now I'm changing both coordinates and fields. I can change fields as well, such that such that my action does not change. So then we say we have a symmetry. We have found a symmetry of the action. Then we have the corresponding conserved current, so J mu given by T mu nu canonical delta tilde x nu plus dl over d mu phi delta tilde phi is the conserved current, is conserved on shell, meaning we have d mu k mu equals to zero, provided the equations of motion are satisfied, where this t mu nu canonical is called canonical energy momentum tensor. And it's given by t mu nu canonical is eta mu nu, the full Lagrangian density, minus dl over d mu phi d nu phi is the canonical energy momentum tensor. And that's the beauty of that. So we have two important formulas. So one is for the canonical energy momentum tensor, which is this formula here. And then if you have that, you know how to construct a conserved current. So d mu j mu will be equal to zero. And if d mu j mu equals to zero, I can integrate over some surface at time equal to zero. And the same integral will be true at any other later time. So I have a conserved charge. OK, so this is the canonical energy momentum tensor. And that is the total current I have. All right, so now the derivation is exactly the same as what we have done for the particle. OK, you can go through the, I've put it in the study text. It's a couple of lines. I'm not going to do it now. I don't have time for that. But it follows every step is exactly the same, except that when you saw a dot, you just write d mu. OK, that's the only difference, basically. OK, so this is that quite nice thing. So what is this energy momentum tensor? And when you know, this will be conserved? OK, so let's, a few remarks. So the most thing is the energy momentum tensor remark. Energy momentum tensor remark. And so let's assume, so our relativistic field theory, well, it better be invariant under Lorentz transformations. Otherwise, you wouldn't call it relativistic. But it's actually typically, well, it's actually more than that. It's invariant under Poincaré transformations. So it's invariant under Lorentz transformations plus translations. OK? So, and that's true for any theory. So action for relativistic field theories is invariant under Poincaré transformations and you discuss them with Stibra, I guess. So you have Poincaré transformations. So in specifically by translations. Okay, so if I move in space or I move in time, my action remains invariant. Okay, so that's the basic symmetry all the relativistic field theories have. And so what it means is that in these transformations, I am choosing that the delta tilde x mu is constant. I can move in this direction, I can move in that direction, I can move in that direction, or I can move in time direction. So this will be constant shifts in these directions. But I don't do anything with fields. So this will be the symmetry. That's the symmetry. I'm not doing anything with fields, but I'm moving in space and time. All right? And if this is a symmetry, this will be my conserved current. Well, let's see. OK, so delta phi is equal to 0. So this term is not there. And my current is simply given by t mu nu canonical delta x nu. But delta x nu is just epsilon nu. And these have to be constants. We have global continuous symmetries. So it's global. So epsilons do not are not functions of x. They are just constants, right? So in this case, so I can take the constants out. And so in this case, I have actually four conserved currents, which I can, OK, so j mu now becomes t mu nu canonical epsilon nu. But I can take these away because they are constants. So in other words, I have four conserved currents, which I can numerate by index nu, and which are t mu nu canonical. OK, so I have four conserved currents. So if I take nu, OK. So these guys satisfy d mu, j mu, nu equals to 0 on shell. And so if I take nu equal to 0, I will have j mu 0 current, which is conserved. And that will describe conservation of energy. Energy conservation. And then I have three other currents, j mu I, which will describe the momentum conservation. OK, so I have four different currents. So this index nu sort of tells me which current I am in. So this is a Bastard index. It looks the same as the index mu, but it actually enumerates which current I have. OK. And then I have these four conserved currents. But of course, I can still keep the index there and just, you know, remember that the index nu sort of tells me, you know, which current I am considering. But I can write that t mu nu canonical equals to 0, right? So that will be four equations for different nu's. And people write it like that. And then they call that the canonical energy momentum tensor is conserved. OK, so this is a conservation of canonical energy momentum tensor. Conservation of energy momentum tensor. There was a question? Yeah?
Yes. When you said that if we didn't change our fields, it's just that if we see the definition of delta tilde of phi, if we keep phi and not, we don't introduce phi prime, that's the meaning of we don't change the field.
Basically, how this works is that I can just do whatever I want to the fields, and whatever I want to the coordinates. And if I do it, I look at the action. Okay, and if I look at the action, does it change or it doesn't? Right. So that's the spirit of doing this thing here. Of course, there is another version. So in this case, I treat really delta tilde phi and delta tilde x as independent quantities. I just do whatever I need to do so that I find the symmetry. Okay? There is another way how you can do it, and you will do it in field theory, and then you can compare the two things, is that you may understand the transformation of fields. Well, okay, if you change the coordinates, the fields will change by the Taylor expansion. Okay, so then you can understand the change of coordinates as a change of fields. Okay, so in that formulation, you won't have any delta of x, really. All you will be doing is that you will be changing delta phi. Okay, it's an equivalent formulation, almost equivalent. The only problem is that this works only for relativistic field theories. Because if you are changing coordinates, of course, your action has two parts. It's the Lagrangian part, which depends on the coordinates, but also the measure part, d4 of x. So now if you do transformations, like Lorentz transformations, translations, and blah, 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 then your measure does not change under these things. So you don't need to change the measure. If you don't need to change the measure, all you are changing is the Lagrangian. Lagrangian depends on fields, and these fields depend on the coordinates. If I change coordinates, I can always interpret that as a change of field. Okay, but it's only for these special transformations. More generally, my measure will change if I change x. Okay, and then I wouldn't, okay. But anyway, so almost equivalent formulations. Okay, so I'm just choosing this formulation where I'm saying I treat them as independent, I can do whatever I need to do with fields, and whatever I need to do with coordinates, and then I treat them as independent, and this is the prescription. But you will see another prescription in field theory course where you will interpret transformations of coordinates as transformations of fields, but it's only possible because the measure does not change. Okay, so that was a very confusing remark for most of you. but you know, when you discuss the Noether's theorem in field theory, just compare whatever Dan will be doing with whatever I'm doing here, and in the end, they are more or less equivalent prescriptions. At least for relativistic field theories, they are exactly the same thing. But the approach will be slightly different. And I think it's useful to know both approaches. Right, so we have this thing here, and we have conservation of the energy momentum tensor, the canonical energy momentum tensor. So now, of course, relativistic field theories also have to be invariant under Lorentz transformations. Okay, so under rotations and stuff like that. Do you know what will be the corresponding currents? So when we had translations, we had energy momentum tensor. What about the rotations?
Angular momentum.
Aha, exactly. So you would have angular momentum tensor, whatever. So there will be some more complicated object than T mu nu. It will actually have more indices, and it will still be conserved. And that's what you get because of the Lorentz transformation invariance. Okay. And I give a reference where you can explicitly see the version. But what is super interesting about this angular momentum tensor is that if you have particles with spin, for example, the electromagnetic field carries spin 1, okay, so then your angular momentum tensor splits into two parts, into the spin part and into the normal angular momentum part due to the motion. Okay, and so only their sum is conserved. And there is a spin orbital interaction and stuff like that. Okay, so that's quite nice story to discuss what happens under Lorentz transformations. And you get some interesting tensor here. All right, so we know everything about field theory now. And then the last step would be to write down, so now you can write down the action for any field theory. So in particular, interesting action is whether question is whether we can write down the action for our Maxwell's theory, right? And so you will basically play with that in the tutorial today. And you will see that it's actually a little bit tricky, as we discussed yesterday with Bruno. And the trick is that nobody knows how to write down the action in terms of f mu nu. Okay, so you see that you have equations of motion. The Maxwell equations, they depend only on f mu nu, on the field strength. But nobody knows how to write down the action in terms of f mu nu. And so what you really have to do is that you have to write it in terms of the vector potential, a mu. And even then, you are cheating, because once you are writing in terms of a mu, of course, the first set of equations, this one here, is already automatically satisfied. So actually, you are writing your action to recover only the second set of equations. The first set of equations is already put inside. Okay, so this is really, really tricky part. And I don't really understand the reason for this. And as we discussed with Bruno, it's actually much more interesting to look at the magnetic charges as well. And then if you have magnetic charges, you lose that equation because now you cannot write f mu nu in terms of d mu d nu of a nu, because now you have non-trivial right-hand side. And so then the question is how we would do it, and I don't know, is a proposal, which I think.
But they are not like constraints. They are not added in the Lagrangian, in the action of constraints with Lagrangian multipliers.
Maybe you could add them as a constraint, yeah. Maybe. But it's also sort of cheating, right? Okay, so action for Maxwell. And so what I will really want to do is I want to recover all these equations which we have here from the action. And as I said, this action, so let's just be very specific and let's just have one electron or whatever. You can add many more electrons later on, but let's just have action for one electron and electromagnetic field, okay? So now the action will be a function of the vector field, which I just argued for. It cannot be a function of f mu nu. Nobody knows how to do that. And it will be a function of the trajectory of that electron. So this is the field, which is our vector potential, and this will be our electron trajectory. Okay, so first step is to add the action for the electron. The electron is massive particle. We already know what the action for the massive particle is. So it's just minus mass of the electron, c squared is 1, and then d tau. But now d tau I write in terms of d lambda, so it'll be d lambda, and then square root of minus eta mu nu d y mu d lambda d y nu over d lambda. Okay, so that describes our electron. So next, we need to add the action for the electromagnetic field itself. Okay. So now, maybe if you remember your course in electromagnetism, maybe you did write the action for the electromagnetic field. So in the absence of magnetic field, you would just expect that Lagrangian is almost like an energy of the electric field, energy density. So we are interested in Lagrangian density, which is something like energy density. So what is the energy density for electric field?
E squared.
OK, perfect. So it must be something which is E squared. So now if you had magnetic field as well, it would be?
E squared.
It would be B squared. So now we would have a term E squared plus B squared. But the Lagrangian is not really an energy. Hamiltonian would be. OK, so now basically the trick is that instead of plus B squared, you treat magnetic field sort of as a minus potential energy. So then the true Lagrangian would be actually Lagrangian density would be E squared minus B squared. Okay, so instead of plus, which would be the true energy density, you sort of treat B as a potential, so you have T minus V or something like that. It would be the Lagrangian density. Okay, so now this looks good. So the question is, this has to be Lorentz invariant, right? So now what kind of quantity would contain E squared minus B squared, right? What quantity contains E and B?
F squared.
So E and B is containing F, right? But now I need squares, right? So this must be F mu nu. There's nothing else I can write down, okay? It's F mu nu. Well, that's not true. I can write another thing. I can write F mu nu and Hodge star of F mu nu. That's the other possibility. If you did that, you would find another invariant, If you did write f mu nu star of f mu nu, that's the other possibility, you would find e times b. That's also a scalar, which you can, but these are the only two invariants in the electromagnetic field you can write down. Okay? So people consider this possibility as well, but it's not the Maxwell's theory, it's beyond Maxwell. So you would, you could have a function of this thing here as well, but you would go beyond Maxwell. So let's just do Maxwell, and then let's put a stupid factor 1 minus 1 over 16 pi, why not? And so then we integrate over space and time, and our Lagrangian density is f mu nu, f mu nu. And it precisely corresponds to this invariant here. Okay? So the warning I made is that here what we assume is this f mu nu is composed out of a mu. A nu minus d nu a mu is assumed here, which really means the first set of equations is already satisfied. So I understand this as a function of a rather than f. Okay? Very good. So we have now electromagnetic field, which happily lives in our spacetime. And we have our electron, which happily lives in our spacetime. But these don't know about each other at this point. They do not interact. We have the free electromagnetic field here, which is this thing here. And we have the free electron moving on geodesic, on straight lines here. So finally, in order these to interact, we need to add an interaction term. And so it looks like, and I am not sure about the minus sign, but that's, well, okay, we shall see. So then, what is the interaction? So you know that the electron, as it moves through your spacetime, it produces a current. Okay? Current naturally couples to the gauge potential A mu. Okay, so the interaction term is simply just the current produced by the electron times the electric field. Okay, so it's the, okay, so current, what is current? Is electric charge times the velocity. Dy mu over d lambda. So that's the four velocity. And then we have a mu, so four velocity times e is the current. And then d lambda. Okay, so this is the interaction term. And that's it. So we have free fields, free electron, and their interaction. And that's the whole Maxwell's theory can be derived from this action. Two remarks. One remark is this seems like this is not gauge invariant. If I change a mu to a mu plus d lambda, d mu of lambda, you know, I pick up an extra term here. So whereas this term is gauge invariant, this one is not. But actually, it will be if you assume that your current is conserved. So if you have conservation of the current, d mu j mu equals to zero, then you can show that the change is actually a total derivative and doesn't contribute. Okay, so this is gauge invariant provided the current is conserved. That's first remark. Second remark, I just forgot. What was the second remark? Okay, so how do I get the equations of motion? Is that I vary with respect to the potential that gives me the Maxwell's equations. And I vary with respect to the trajectory of the particle, and I get the Lorentz force law. Okay? So this is what you will do in today's tutorial. And I think you will have lots of fun here. Okay, so that's the complete theory of electromagnetism. So I have 5 minutes, so I will not really do anything more. So now what I promised then to do is to actually discuss scalar field theory, which I don't have time. But scalar field theory with respect to this thing is completely, you know, it's completely boring. So basically, you know, you can write an action for the scalar field theory where you really your field is just a scalar. And if you do that, you find that the equation of motion is this one here. Okay. So, which is the Klein-Gordon equation. So now, why you would be doing this? Okay, so why do you want to discuss scalar field theory? In this theory of electromagnetism, we went halfway. So we wanted to discuss interactions of matter with this electromagnetic field, but we treated the electromagnetic field, well, as a field, it's F mu nu, but we treated the matter as a point particle. Okay, so we treated the electron as just a motion of a test point particle in the space-time. So matter was a particle, it was still described by classical mechanics, but fields were field theory. So now the next step would be, of course, to replace the electron with a field as well. Okay, so now you want to replace thing, and then you would have interaction of matter fields with electromagnetic field, F mu nu. So the first idea you could have is that, well, let's use scalar field to describe our electron. Okay, so now if you do it that way, you will soon find that if you just have a real scalar field, then there is no conserved current. So I cannot write down the interaction term for a real scalar field with the electromagnetic field. It's impossible to have a conserved current. So then you say, well, what is the next simplest thing to do? Well, the next simplest thing to do would be consider a complex scalar field. Okay, so now I have phi, but I also have phi star. Okay, so now I have like two fields. I can treat them as phi and phi star independent. So I have two fields. Once you do that and you have a complex scalar field, you have conserved charge. Okay, so then you can actually write down the conserved current and you can write down the interaction term here. So in this case, you would have scalar electrodynamics. Scalar electrodynamics. And there is nothing wrong with it, except it doesn't really describe electron. And the reason why it doesn't describe the electron is that scalar fields don't carry any spin. Whereas you know that the electron has spin 1/2. Okay? So in order to describe true electron as a field, you need to go from scalar field to a Dirac field. So you take square root of d square minus m square, and you arrive at the Dirac equation. Okay, so really it's taking square root of this. And so Dirac field carries the spin 1/2 spin. You can write down the current for it, and you can couple it to electromagnetic field. That will be your quantum electrodynamics. Okay, so we are almost there. Scalar field is not enough. Well, real scalar field doesn't have conserved current, so I cannot do it. Complex scalar field does. So you can have scalar electrodynamics, but it doesn't really describe our nature because electron carries spin. So you need to go to the Dirac equation and to the Dirac field, which carries spin 1/2, and then you will have the full electrodynamics. So that's your future in the quantum field theory, which you will do in quantum field theory 1. And of course, another future, which is immediately in 1 week or whatever, is that all I have been doing here in relativistic field theories was in flat space. So we didn't have gravity. We just sort of forgot about gravity and said gravity is not important, or we just don't know how to treat it. So next step at the classical level will be to look at, you know, how to include the gravitational field, which will be the subject of the relativity course. And of course, the next step will be how to quantize gravity, which you will have another course about it later on. But really, it's not done yet, right? So anyway, so here, let me stop here. And I hope you had as fun as I had. So we have a tutorial on this in the afternoon. Thank you. Oh, thank you.